Welcome, everyone, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Baudrin, and with me is my co-host from Culebra, Puerto Rico, Señor Barry Rose. Barry, ¿cómo está?
Muy bien, gracias. I'm training special for this podcast, and I'm ready for any kind of action.
Well, that's what they say about you, Barry. You're always ready for action. And on this show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, wrestling, or break kayfabe on friggin' life. And, you know, Barry, I've been thinking about the fact that right now there's this all-in thing going on in Chicago, and there's podcasters from all over the country there. There are people with thousands and thousands of listeners. There's people that have 50 or 60 listeners. There's people that, quite frankly, have 10 or 12 listeners. And, you know, I don't have to tell you that things are bad, Barry. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everyone's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat, and we sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything, everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let us have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write your congressman, because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to your window, open it, stick your head out and yell, I'm mad as hell. And I want to break kayfabe on life with Baudrin and Barry. So Barry, how was your week?
Wow. Well, a couple of thoughts after that. That was epic. But to that end, how the fuck did we not include that quote last week when we were doing the greatest quotes for movies? Obviously. That is that was the late great Peter Finch, who I believe actually won an Academy Award based off of that quote, correct?
Well, I'm guessing if the Academy wants to nominate me, you know, I will perhaps attend to the Academy Awards next year. But, you know, for your consideration, maybe our producer, the great Brian Laft, will submit my name for nomination. So, folks, boy, to quote the late, great Jerry Reed, we got a long way to go and a short time to get there. We got tons to talk about.
Wait a minute. Jerry Reed is dead?
Isn't he? Well, if he's not, Jerry, I really freaking apologize, but
sorry, Jerry.
It's been
yeah,
a long time. Anyway, so we've got a lot to talk about today, folks, because as you may know, I've just come back from the great city of Philadelphia, where I stayed in a low-rent motel. Oh, I stayed with the Rose family. It was a beautiful home in suburban Ambler, Pennsylvania. Had a great time visiting. Got to meet Ozzy for the first time, Barry's beloved dog. They stuck me in the basement, though, quite frankly. I think they were ashamed of the fact that I was there. So, Barry, we had a great week. We're going to talk about the ROH taping. We're going to take a look back at a fantastic match from Houston Wrestling in 1977. And as if that weren't enough, we are going to offer up our top five. Top five, Barry, I know you're ready for this one. One-hit wonders of the 1980s. Yes, we're going back to the 80s, and we're going to offer our one-hit wonders. I'll offer a few qualifications before we start our list. So, wow, Barry, you about ready to go?
It sounds like we've got like a 6-hour show here, so I'm absolutely
it could
ready
be.
To go.
I hope Brian is on standby going, holy fuck, how long is this show going to take? So before we start, Barry, a couple things I got to talk about. One, we'll delve into, or we'll morph into, excuse me, that's a better way of saying it, a courthouse story, which we haven't offered here in a couple weeks. But I got to tell you, Barry, about my visit to get my shoulder looked at. As you know, one of the things I was discussing with you while I was up in Philadelphia, you know, got a problem with my shoulder. The doctor is worried that I might have a torn rotator cuff. So I went to get the old MRI. Barry, have you had an MRI lately?
It's been years.
Okay. So you're familiar with the process though, right?
I am. Yep.
Okay. So folks, I go to get an MRI, and I've had an MRI previously. And, you know, for those of you who are unaware of what this is, they basically take you and they stick your entire body into this tube where you are literally completely surrounded And then they begin the, let's see, it's the magnetic resonance test, I believe is what MR stands for. Anyway, so, and you are just hit with this cacophony of noise. They give you earmuffs to hide it. So anyway, so I had requested, because I'd had one previously, a what they call an open MRI. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to go in there. It's going to be kind of casual. It's kind of like getting an X-ray, okay? So I go in there. Well, to start off with, I get there, and the lady at the front desk says, oh, okay, so we're getting ready to do an MRI on your right shoulder. I said, look, if you want to do an MRI on my right shoulder, that's fine, but I got to tell you, you're not going to find anything because the problem's with my left shoulder. I then have to call the doctor's office to get them to change the prescription to the left shoulder. I mean, like, Barry, come on. Like, what am I supposed to do here? The guy didn't get the shoulder right, you know? So then I go in, go from the lobby to the waiting room, and then the guy comes out to give me the MRI, takes me, throws me in the tube with very little prep, okay? So I go in there. He says, going to be about 15 minutes. Gives me a set of earphones or earmuffs. And so as they start off, I'm getting a little country and Western music, okay? Somebody's singing about a truck or a dog or his girlfriend that broke his heart. I don't know. But then the claustrophobia starts setting in. And I'm like maybe 8 minutes in. And all of a sudden, quite frankly, I start freaking out a little bit. And so I'm kind of waving to the guy. I might need to change this. This isn't working out. And I'm like waving my feet because this guy is not acknowledging me. So finally, I kind of crane my neck up as little as I can, because you literally have about 3 inches between your face and the top of the MRI. And I see the guy leaning back in his chair. I'm like, holy fuck, this guy does not see me. So I begin bang, 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 tapping on the side of the MRI machine. Guy comes in. He goes, what's the problem? I go, dude, you got to get me. I'm tapping out. I got to get out of here. I'm freaking out because it's just too much. You know, I'm too claustrophobic. The guy says, oh, well, if they had told me you were claustrophobic, I would have made accommodations for you. Oh, that's nice. That's nice. Hey, yeah, all you got to do is get your doctor to write you a prescription for a Xanax or a Vicodin and come back tomorrow. I said, excuse me? He goes, yeah, just take one before you leave home and it'll be kicking in. And then when you get here, you take another one and then you'll be good to go. I go, and how exactly am I going to get home? Because I'm certainly not going to drive after two Vikings. Ah, just get like your wife or something to bring you. So I'm like, what planet does this guy live on where he thinks I've got time to just take out of my day? Sure, I'll just take a pop of Vicodin and come down. Don't worry about my job. But yeah, it was quite the cluster F. So now tomorrow, as we're recording this on a Thursday night, tomorrow I'm going to the doctor, the orthopedic, who's going to look at my shoulder. And hopefully, God, he will tell me that I do not have to have surgery. That was my MRI story. Barry, I don't like having MRIs. I found out I'm a tad claustrophobic. Did you have that particular sensation when you got it?
I don't remember. It was 1983, so we're a solid 35 years, and it was my ankle.
Well,
and I remember the banging. I just remember this really, really loud banging is the only thing that I remember. But I had tendon and ligament damage in my ankle. So yeah, so I remember that, but I don't remember if it was full body or if it was just the ankle. But yeah, so claustrophobia is kind of a weird thing. I would probably be good with that, but I can tell you years ago, I went, there was an area in Kentucky. I know we have some listeners in Kentucky, and, it was an area in Kentucky where there were caves, and we went into these caves, and there was one part in the cave that you take this, it's kind of like a secret tunnel, but you actually have to get on your knees and elbows to get through it. And I remember being in there going, oh, this fucking sucks. Like, I want out of here. And I literally just started booging right through this thing as fast as I could. I hated that. So claustrophobia is a weird thing. It's like, you know, the guy's asking you, well, if I knew you were claustrophobic, and you're like, well, I didn't fucking know I was claustrophobic.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happens. You don't really realize it.
Yeah, you know, I remember, what was it, about a month or so ago when that soccer team, was it like Thailand or somewhere in Southeast Asia, that area, where they got stuck in the caves, and they showed basically the cave system that the rescue group had to go through to get to these kids. And I mean, you're talking like you got maybe 3 or 4 inches on either side of you as you're trying to get through this thing. And, you know, these guys are carrying tanks behind them, like oxygen tanks. And I was just like, holy crap, man, if one of those guys starts wigging out in the middle of those caves, it must be horrible. But now the part that relates to the courthouse somehow, because I got to tell you, Barry, one of the funniest things that I ever saw. So I get from the lobby to the waiting room before I go in and see the tech. Okay. And it's me and this older woman in the room, and she's on the phone, and apparently she's had a real bad day. And so she's talking about how apparently there was, she was the caretaker or was watching a child who had been the custody of the child had been returned to the birth mother. And she had spent some time in court. And of course, she's sitting there talking about this, not knowing that I work at the courthouse. And so on the phone, she proceeds to tell the person she's speaking to, yeah, you know, they don't care about the child. They don't care about the child. Oh, these attorneys, all they want is money. They don't care about their defendants or the people they're representing. All they want is money. That's all they want. And the judges, they don't want to have anything, tying up their dockets. All they want to do is move the cases. They don't even look at the case. They don't even look at the file and see what's going on with the case. All they care about is they don't care about the kids. But let me tell you something about that mother. I'm going to tell you about that mother. She thinks this is it. No, though. This is not it, because she is going to have to face something even worse than that, judge, because you know what I've decided? Yeah, I'm going to tell you what I've decided. I am going to see that she gets on the Dr. Phil show. So Barry, apparently Dr. Phil is the ultimate authority here in this country.
Well, I think he is. It's like, isn't he like he's the number one guy?
Yeah, he's a go-to man. You know,
he's the go-to guy for everything. Absolutely.
Yeah, used to be Springer or Maury Povich, but now apparently it's Dr. Phil. Okay, Barry, now it's time to turn our attention to the city of brotherly love. Had a chance to fly up there.
Jeff, before we get there,
what time this is?
You know what time? Are you looking at your watch? Do you know what time this is?
You're right. I think it's time for America's Favorite Game Show.
It's America's Favorite Game Show. It is the letters F, Marry, and Kill. And Jeff, we are going to go back in time a little bit with this one to one of, I believe, your favorite television shows of all time. I believe if it's not my favorite TV show of all time, it certainly is in the top five, but may be the best television show of all time. Of course, Jeff, I'm talking about AMC's Breaking Bad. And I have picked three female characters. Inspiration came to me today as I was reading about one of them, and I'm like, wait a minute, there were actually some attractive women on that show as well. We never discuss it, but your choices tonight would be Kristen Ritter, who played Jane Margolis. If you remember, she was the young lady who was Pinkman's girlfriend for a time and then had a drug overdose. Walter White's wife.
Always nice to get the chance to, F. Mary Kill with a junkie. That's nice.
With a junkie who overdoses. Absolutely. Yeah. But exactly. Anna Gunn, who played Skylar White, the wife of Walter White. And then Betsy Brandt, the very attractive Marie Schrader, who played the wife of Hank Schrader, and we all know what happened to Hank at the very end. No spoilers here, but I think we all know what happened to Hank. So you have three options. You have the junkie, you've got the wife of the guy making the meth, and then you've got what's essentially the widow of Hank in Betsy Brandt. So where are you going? You're going to go Marie Schrader, Skylar White, or Jane Margolis?
Let me just hold on a second. Let me pull it up. Right away.
Are you pulling up photos?
I got to see the photos just for a quick recollection.
Okay, I don't blame you.
Because the first thing I thought of was, oh, I'm going to kill Skylar without question. She was such a bitch on that show. But, all things considered, the actress that plays her, Anna Gunn, is not a unattractive woman. Wait a minute. Am I F marrying killing the actress or the characters? That's
totally
important.
I'm going to go off of, I guess we got, I don't know. What do you do? What do we usually do? Do we usually go off of characters or do we whatever you want. How about that? Okay. A little creative liberty, you decide.
Well, obviously I'm going to kill the junkie because, you don't want to pick anything up.
She was so attractive.
That's true. She really was. I'm going to F Anna Gunn because I don't think you want to be married to someone who's quite as manipulative as Skylar was. But to be fair, her sister in the show, Betsy Brandt, was quite manipulative. So I guess I'm going to F Anna Gunn. We're going to kill Margolis, and I'm going to marry Betsy Brandt and probably end up regretting it because she's going to run my life right into the ground.
Yeah, I think so, too. But I'll tell you that Kristen Ritter, who played Jane Margolis, was also on Jessica Jones, the TV show, which I don't watch. My wife was watching and I caught her and I'm like, who is that? Why does she look so, she's very attractive. Why does she look so familiar? And she goes, that was the girl that was Pinkman's girlfriend, that OD'd. And, that was, what a great show, Breaking Bad. And, it's one of those shows too that if it was around now, and certainly in reruns or whatever, you can watch it on Netflix, but if it was a show that was current, I have a feeling that you and I would be talking about it every single week and every single episode because it was that good of a show.
Yeah, it was. It was it was a landmark show in a lot of ways. And, you know, for those of you now that follow Better Call Saul, they are introducing characters who were in Breaking Bad, and they are slowly beginning to develop the characterization that you would see, because, of course, the show takes place in the past and will eventually catch up to the Breaking Bad timeline. But that's a great show, too. You know, and I know that's something that Barry and I, you know, Tuesday or Wednesday, well, hey, did you catch Better Call Saul the other night? So let's talk about both great shows. Let's talk about my trip to Philadelphia. I had a chance to go up to Casa de Rose. And first of all, Barry, because we know we have this segment of our listeners that like to hear our food stories, let's talk about the food aspect before we get to the ROH taping. We had a chance to visit a place, Barry, that you had been telling me about for months, a place called Curiosity Donuts, right there in beautiful, lovely Ambler, Pennsylvania. Barry, you're our food guy. Why don't you tell us what makes Curiosity Donuts just so special?
Yeah, absolutely, too. Then I can also tell you what my personal connection, if you people already haven't figured out what my personal connection is to Curiosity. So, I do love food, and it's one of these things. I know people that eat three meals a day that could really give a shit what they're eating, and I think they eat to live. And for me, I live to eat. It is every meal should mean something. Every time I eat something, I want it to count, and I want it to truly be epic. So there's a place called Curiosity Donuts, and it's like a kiosk, essentially, and it's in a Whole Foods. It's a brand new Whole Foods. It's maybe 6 to 8 months old, relatively new. It's just the most beautiful facility you've ever seen. And Whole Foods, for years, had this negative stigma attached to it, and that it was way overpriced. They used to call it Whole Paycheck because it was so expensive to go in there, Jeff. But the quality of meats, it really is far superior to your average grocery store. Very sorry, Chris Zaha. But at the same time, Amazon purchased Whole Foods, I'll say within the last year, and the prices have gone down. So I do a lot of, like, we buy our steaks, we buy some of our produce, we buy our chicken.
You definitely buy the chicken there. I can assure the listeners of that.
You were there.
Lord.
You were actually there as I was buying chicken and steak this past week. But there is Curiosity Donuts. And Curiosity Donuts was started by a guy named Chef Alex. And Alex was a legitimate chef. He had owned restaurants. He's a restaurant consultant. He's an outstanding cook. He and his wife have written several books that are available. You can go into Barnes & Noble, get them through Amazon. They've written several books on food and cooking preparations, etc. So he opened up Curiosity Donuts, and I believe he's relatively new. When I say new, within the last couple of years to the donut business. So the first time I discovered Curiosity Donuts, and I told the owner, Chef Alex, this, I decided on a Friday afternoon that I was going to start watching what I was eating, noticing I've got a couple extra, I'm two sizes bigger than I should be. It's all in the gut. I'm a little sluggish, and I'm getting older. Maybe I should watch what I'm eating. So Friday, I make that decision. Everything's great. Saturday, everything's great. Sunday morning, my wife takes me to Whole Foods to go shopping, and there, with a shining light, is Curiosity Donuts. And immediately I look at these donuts, and they're literal works of art. But unlike like French pastries, if you've ever had a French pastry, they sometimes are absolutely beautiful, and then you bite it and go, yeah, it's okay, it's great. You know, it's so, in my opinion, great food doesn't always have to look great to taste great. In any case, these donuts really looked good. So I looked at all the donuts, and I think I wound up getting three, and I took a bite of the Kroller. And the Kroller, I think I've mentioned this previously, but the Kroller is essentially the same dough that they use to make French eclairs with. So it's kind of this light, flaky layers of dough, and it's called pâte à choux. It's a French pâte à choux dough. So I took a bite of the Kroller, and immediately after one bite, I said to my wife, I said, okay, you know, I don't want to, because I do this a lot, actually, but I'll say, this is the greatest donut I've ever had. And she's like, nah, come on, you know, we've had some good donuts. And you and I have talked about donuts a lot, because we both love donuts. So she goes, all right, give me a bite of the donut. And she took a bite, and she goes, okay, that's the greatest fucking donut I've ever had. So we sat there, we went back and forth, we got like a dozen donuts and we got plastic knives and we sat down and we started trying these donuts. And my wife is like, oh my God, you know, and these are $3 a donut. And before anybody gets bent out of shape that Dunkin' Donuts is a dollar, there's a reason Dunkin' Donuts is a dollar per donut. You know, it's like going to McDonald's for a dollar burger and saying it's the best burger you've had. No, there are restaurants that serve amazing burgers that may cost you $10, $15, or $20. So there is a difference in what you're getting. So I knew at that point that it was over for me once I discovered these donuts. This whole trying to eat healthy shit was right out the window. It was over. And I brought my son in probably 2 weeks later, and I had become a little friendly because now I was going three or four times a week to get these fucking donuts. So I was gaining more weight now that I've decided to eat healthy. And I started talking to the owner, Alex, and I was like, you know, my son, he's never had a job and he's looking for a summer job. And Alex says, you know, this is perfect timing. I just had a guy he left on me. How soon can he start? My son was with me. My son said, I could be here tomorrow. And there it was, a father standing with his son proudly as he gets his first job at what I consider the greatest donut place ever. So for me, there was a tear in my eye. There was hope in my heart that I'll be getting free donuts, which I do sometimes. And it was really, really exciting. But these donuts are at a different level. And they are, first off, they're $3 a donut. This is not your average donut. It is a work of art, but the flavor profile. So we tried a donut, Jeff, and I liked all the donuts that we tried that day. And I had tried this donut, and I don't know why it didn't hit me, but we got this blueberry pull-apart. And essentially what it is it's like little round pieces of dough. So I don't want to say munchkin because I don't want to bastardize it that way, but it's little round donuts all formed together that you can pull apart, topped with a fresh blueberry sauce. So it's not even a blueberry glaze. It's legitimate blueberries. And we were fortunate. We had Chris Spiker and his lovely fiance Christine with us. And Chris manages a donut shop maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes away from here. And it's a different type of donut. It's, you know, it's completely different. And even Chris said, that's the best donut I've ever had. And Christine, who also knows donuts pretty well and does know food pretty well, says, okay, these are the best donuts I've ever had. So, you know, I think it was kind of unanimous that when you try these donuts, and this again, you know, this isn't a chocolate glaze with sprinkles on it. I don't think they do any that have sprinkles on it. So it's not a, you know, a Mr. Donut, which I don't think exists, or a Dunkin' Donut.
I remember Mr. Donut.
Remember Mr. Donut? And I used to like Mr. Donut.
Those were good.
Our good friend that we'll be talking about coming up shortly, Eric Chulminski, he goes to Mr. Donut. The last Mr. Donut is in Japan.
Wow.
And every time he goes over to Japan, he sends me photos from Mr. Donut. So I think it's pretty cool. But we were fortunate. We spent Saturday morning hanging out with Chris Spiker and Christine, and we got some donuts. And Jeff, what did you – I mean, you know, so I drug you. I was like, Jeff, we got to go try these donuts. And I think it's 10:30, and I'm dragging you into Whole Foods to try these donuts. And we literally get a box of – I think it was eight donuts when we sit down. But what did you think about these donuts?
Well, here's what I thought about the cruller. I thought when you look at it, just the look of it, it looks like it's the same consistency as like an apple fritter, the pastry itself. But what happens is when you bite into it or you cut it with a knife and fork, the pastry is hollow and there's all this glaze onto it and you bite into it and it's just like, Mara. It's just like, Mama, it is great. And that was good. I later tried, they have, beignets where they give you like, I don't know, four or six beignets that are just off. It's like, man, I was sitting there thinking were how great these donuts were. And then I tried the blueberry one, how great these donuts are. And holy crap, what is happening? My sugar. I'm so glad that nobody is around to check what my sugar is because it was probably like, you know, something like 3000 or something like that. But I mean, it was just off the charts good. Folks, if you are ever in the Philadelphia area, you don't even have to go see Barry Rose because maybe you don't want to see Barry Rose, but you know, he'll probably be there and you can say hello to him. You can say hello to his son, Zach, who's probably going to be working there, and make it a point to go out of your way and go to this donut place because it is unstinking believable. Besides that, we also had a chance. What was the name of the Mexican place we went to by you, Barry?
Yeah, so being that, you know, that we were on this little mini eating tour as well. So we ate the donuts somewhere between 10:30 and 11. And then about 12:30, we figured it was time for lunch. And we went to a place called El Limon, which is also in downtown Ambler. And El Limon is a local, I don't want to say chain, because chain to me is just such a nasty word, but it's a local restaurant that has six different locations. And it's all throughout the greater Philadelphia suburbs. And we've been fans of El Limon probably for the last 5 years. You can get in and out of El Limon. You pay, it's $8 a burrito. They give you free margaritas if you want a margarita. It's really inexpensive, but the food is really tasty. And it was kind of cool because it was me, you, Chris, and Christine. And then we went and got Ozzy, and we all sat outside, and Ozzy got to eat some chips as well.
Ozzy likes it. He doesn't like the chips with the salsa. He's more of a plain chip dog, yeah, you know, which we can understand. So, and after that, we had a chance to meet up with some old friends, Jamie Ward, Ron Lemieux, guys I hadn't seen in, geez, like over 20 years minimum, Barry. And we had put out there on the board that we were, you know, going for some for the proverbial Philly cheesesteak, and everyone's offering, you know, you go to Gino's or Pat's or whatever the places are downtown. And oh, those are tourist traps. You want to go to this place. So where you end up taking me is a place called John's Roasted Pork. And holy moly, is this place good, Barry?
Holy moly. So I'm embarrassed to admit it. I had never been there before. I had driven by 50 times, maybe a little bit more, maybe 75.
What sort of Philadelphia native are you?
Well, I'm not a Philadelphia native.
Well, I mean, you live there. That's what I mean.
I'm a Philadelphia resident, and when I said it to Jamie Ward that I'd never been there, he looks at me and he goes, "What do you mean? You're a food guy. How could you have never?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I fucked up. I fucked up royally by never going in there because," and I will say this, that was the best cheesesteak I've ever had. And again, I do say when something is, it was, but here's the thing. I think it was so far number one, that it number two is so, it's just way, way behind. So it's a great spot. It literally from the old ECW arena is probably a 5 minute walk, if even that. And, you get into this building and you have to order your food. You stand in line to order and then you got to wait for your order. And we stood in line for about 20 minutes and it was a good little pop they were getting. And then we sit outside, no air conditioning. But I'm going to tell you the difference between this and other cheesesteaks. And Jamie, I know Jamie's listening. And, the truth is I've been thinking about this cheesesteak all week, which is what happens when I eat something and I love it and it's brand new. It's all I think about. So I've been thinking about it and I think I'm going to make the trip either Saturday or Sunday. Today we're recording on a Thursday, but one day this weekend, we're supposedly getting a lot of rain here, which takes care of the beach for me. So I'm going to get it, but the roll was incredible. So what the difference with the roll versus most cheesesteaks I had, this one actually had sesame seeds on it.
That's
which
true.
Normally they don't. The meat was actually pieces of steak. So in Philadelphia, you can get there's some places, Pat's and Gino's are different as well. One does sliced, so you're actually getting slices of steak, and the other one is chopped. This was chopped, but the meat was actual pieces of steak. So it's a thicker piece of steak as opposed to these very, very thin pieces. Then they, with the onions, they're not just putting on these tiny little brown onions. They were pieces of onion. I love onion. That were cooked properly, and they topped it with a sharp provolone. I know that you got a mild provolone, but I took a bite of this cheesesteak. And the best part, like my son's sitting next to me, and he actually got the roast pork, sharp provolone, and sauteed spinach. And it's called John's Roast Pork. And my son, who normally, you can't shut him up, he's a mile a minute. We don't hear a peep out of this kid for 15 minutes. All he's doing is sitting there completely devouring his food. But we sat there, and I'm eating this, and I'm just like, every bite, I'm just savoring. It was absolutely incredible. I will be going back shortly. I think Jamie and I are also going to try to meet and grab lunch there. And there's another ROH card coming in October, and Eric and I are already making plans to go. And I damn sure I'm going to go to John's Roast Pork before that show. But it was, you know, that was the beauty, Jeff. You coming up here and Jamie Ward, who grew up in the area. Jamie's local. Eric lives 5 minutes away from South Philly. So these guys were really familiar with John's Roast Pork, and it was head and shoulders above any other cheesesteak I've ever had. And Pat's and Gino's, so I know we were discussing this on the board. I can't tell you what a disappointment it was for me to go. And I went to both, and I went consecutively. I went and got a sandwich at one and then went to the other one and got a sandwich. They were like $14 a cheesesteak. So right there, it's telling you something's wrong. But the quality of the cheesesteak is, it's mediocre at best. There's nothing there that signifies this is a great sandwich. What we had, John's Roast Pork, that was one of the greatest fucking sandwiches I've ever had. Even cooler the fact that the owner sees us outside and initiates a conversation and thanks us for coming in, which I thought was a cool touch. So that was a great experience.
Yeah, that was a nice touch at the end with the owner coming out and chit-chatting with us as we were taking a picture in front of his place. So then, Barry, the next day is Sunday. This is after the taping, which, of course, we're going to get to. And Barry takes me into downtown Philly. We pick up our friend Eric Chulminski, and Barry lets me experience for the very first time, I'd never been there before, Reading Terminal. And holy, well, by the way, we decided not to go to the Vietnamese place that Howard Baum said 22 years ago was outstanding. We decided to go to Reading Terminal instead, Howard. Sorry about that. But holy crap, you walk into this place. And for those of you that have never been there, you're basically in an area approximately the size of an entire city block. You have this building, and inside the building, there's probably 50, 60, maybe 70 restaurants, not one single chain restaurant, all individually owned. You have everything from pizza and subs. You have Italian, what else? We got Amish food there. You've got ice cream, cookies. You've got Pakistani food, soul food, every kind of food, deli. Everything you can imagine is in this place, and it's just an absolute madhouse because it's so packed. There's a jazz band playing in the middle of the thing, and I'm going, what in God's name is this? And it was absolutely amazing. I had a chance to stop in to Danik's, which is one of the famous places that's in there. Barry, I know you went to the deli. Eric went and got some fried chicken, and we sat there, and it was absolutely amazing just people watching and enjoying this great food. And it's a place that I told my wife when I got home, I said, we got to go to Philly because I got to take you to this Reading Terminal. It's just absolutely stinking amazing.
It really is, too. So years ago, and it was kind of a gimmick, but there's a place in Seattle, and I don't know, I forget exactly what it's called, but it's a very similar type of place, the Seattle Marketplace or something like that. And there was an article that came out, and it was basically, which is better, is it Reading Terminal Marketplace or this place in Seattle? And when the article had finished up, it was a tie, which tells you it was bullshit. But if there's anywhere else like this on the face of the earth, and actually there are in the some European countries, but this is an absolutely, absolutely incredible place. And every time I'm in Philly, I always go, okay, where should I go for lunch today? And I always think in my head, I'm going to go here. Literally 14 out of 15 times, I always wind up at Reading Terminal Marketplace. And then I walk in, and it's amazing. And let alone the types of food, as you said, there's Pakistani, there were ducks hanging, there's Chinese food, there's a Peking duck place, there's a Greek place, there's sushi, there's burgers, there's a turkey place, but there's a deli called Herschel's Deli, and it's probably one of the top five delis I've ever been to. It's certainly my favorite deli locally. It's really the only deli that we have locally, and what they do that's different is they hand-cut all the meat for the sandwiches. They hand carve it, and there's no other deli in Philadelphia currently doing that. And there's a place in New York, which everybody knows, Katz's, down on Houston Street, which is real famous. And I know some of our readers were there over the last couple of months because they were posting photos, and they hand cut their meats there. You know, that's a big deal that you're not on a slicer. You know, you're not getting the same thickness for every slice. There's a guy cutting it. It's a little, every piece is unique. So to me, that's it. But I'll get into Reading Terminal. I'll walk around. I'll spend a half an hour. And invariably, I always get right back to this deli, and I'm always getting pastrami and a knish. So it's great. I have tried, though. There's a Cajun place. I've eaten at the Cajun place numerous times, but it's, you know, it's got everything you need. If you want, as you said, cookies, if you, there's two different cookie places in there. There's two different ice cream places. There's several different bakeries, and you didn't even get the full experience because going on a Sunday, a lot of these, some of these stores are actually closed in there because of the Amish. The Amish do not work on Sundays. So, so Byler's Donuts, which is a really, it's in my top five donut of all time. Byler's Donuts is closed. And there's also, they also have a bakery and a barbecue place. And that's closed as well. But yeah, if you can get your wife up here, and really it's kind of cool because it's really attached to the Hilton Garden Inn Hotel. You stay at the Hilton Garden. You could just walk right over, have every meal, walk right back to the hotel, whatever you want to do.
Yeah, it was really good. And of course, the funniest part of it is after we were done, the three of us walked around downtown a little bit. And I said, you know, it's time for us to probably start heading to the airport. I got to catch a flight. I got a 5:15 flight. And Barry was trying to weave through downtown traffic and dropped me off at the airport at about, I want to say 4:30-ish. And thank God for the old TSA pre-check, because when I got there, I found out my flight was actually leaving in about 15 minutes, and they were started to board. So I was doing the sprint through the airport and had enough time to grab me a bottle of water and get on the plane. So my wife, who is one of these people that believes in getting to the airport approximately 3 hours before the flight is scheduled to leave, she would have been in a complete panic. I can guarantee you that. Okay, let's go back. Well,
Jeff, I want to throw one more thing, and then I want to get your thoughts on this. So After I dropped you off, I went and I dropped off Eric, and Eric and I hung out for a little bit. And then I went and I picked up my wife and my daughter, who were shopping in downtown Philly that day. So we stopped in at a place called Capogiro. And Capogiro is an ice cream place. It's Italian ice cream, Italian sorbet, and Italian pastries. And I tried what I just thought was an epic combination. And I'm going to explain this. It was two different types of ice cream I got. One was Thai coconut. So it was like coconut milk. And I guess because Thais cook a lot with coconut. And with that, I got avocado ice cream, Jeff. Now, my first question, do you like avocados?
No.
Gotcha. I love avocados. I could eat, as we're recording this, I haven't had dinner. So the thought of now guacamole is in my head, but so avocado ice cream. So on the surface, as somebody who likes ice cream and avocados, it seems disgusting. However, the guy said, you really want to try this. And I did. So it's avocados. I don't know what else they put. They're putting in a ton of sugar, but avocados are really smooth and creamy. And this was the creamiest ice cream I've ever had. And then has this sweetness and freshness coming from the avocado mixed in with a lot of sugar. So I walked away, and you mix this with the Thai coconut, and it was just fucking devastating. And I go to my daughter and I'm like, you want to try this? And she's like, I'm not eating that. I'm not, it's a vegetable. I'm not having any fucking vegetables in my ice cream, which I get, you know, who wants vegetables in their ice cream?
That's so kind of odd that Zoe would say that, Jordan. I'm not having any fucking vegetables, Dad. That's, you know.
Well, she left out the F word.
Well, that's nice.
Left out the F word. Thank God. But she tried it and goes, wow, that's really good. And then my wife got it. My wife said, oh my God, this is absolutely amazing. So yeah, on the surface, avocado ice cream sounds disgusting, but no, it's really, really fantastic.
Yeah. So, okay. Now, Barry, what do you say? We're about 40 minutes in. We probably haven't even brought up wrestling yet. So let's talk about the ROH show that we went to. We went to the ROH show, the big TV taping for, I guess, for the next few weeks of ROH. The 2300 building? Is that what it's called?
2300 Arena, which was the old Viking Hall. And it was basically where ECW had all their shows.
Yeah, and we go there and we run into old friends. I met Rob Ferry, I'm sorry, as well as the rest of the crew that we had talked about earlier. Was shocked to see some, you know, friends I hadn't seen in a long time. And you had warned me, get ready, because this is not a sprint. It is a marathon. And that's pretty much what it was. But we had a great time and some terrific matches, some good angles. Barry, just initially, why don't you tell the folks what you thought of the show?
Yeah, so what I thought, well, A, it's way too long. It's, you know, when you're in a building, first off, we have to say we've been going through a heat wave in the Northeast, similar to what you guys face on a daily basis in Florida.
But we call that Tuesday.
You call that right, Monday through Sunday. But for us up here, we've been going through a heat wave, and it's been in the 90s every day. And this is a building where it almost seems like this building, and I know this is not the case, but it almost seems like this building has got a window unit somewhere trying to cool off an entire building. Because we sat there, and I just remember I'm sitting next to Zach, and the lights are on us, because they have got these lights, because this is a TV taping. So they've got the really bright lights, and we're just wiping the sweat off our brow. So the show starts at 6. It doesn't end until 11. So it is a marathon. It's 5 hours. There's good and there's bad, as with everything. I'll tell you what I think the strong point of ROH is that they do the most with the least amount. They literally get the most, and maybe that's the booker. I don't know who it is, but there weren't that many guys there that night, you know, and they squeeze everything out to put forth an entertaining product. Bully Ray, Bubba Ray Dudley, who's been in that building for 28 years now, something like that, since the old ECW days, really just a great, mean, bully, mean-spirited heel. He really does a great job. And, anybody that, you know, I know he's in the WWE a year or two ago, and they were part of a tag team, he and D-Von, but when you let him just cut loose, his promos are as good as anybody's as a heel. You naturally hate the guy. He insults everybody. He's tremendous. We got to see the Young Bucks wrestle. The Young Bucks I've seen them wrestle live, I'll say a dozen times. I don't think I've ever been disappointed. They're really entertaining. They're really good. They do some amazing spots. They're not spot monkeys at all. I really enjoy watching them work. Cody Rhodes, and you've mentioned this, Cody's in-ring work is not through the roof. But his promo work and the way he carries himself is as a major league star, and you buy into it. And then the ROH fans there's a hardcore fans, and they've accepted Cody because he truly comes across as a major league star. This 5-hour marathon, a lot of this was really geared towards this weekend that you cut this epic promo on, the StarCast and then the All In event. So, you know, there's some positives there with ROH. Again, I really think that they really go the distance with really trying to get the most of what they have, and they really don't have a lot. They've lost a lot of their roster to other promotions, whether it's primarily NXT, WWE, but, you know, there's other groups out there that guys have left. Some of the negatives, I think it's only fair to discuss that as well. You know, I've said this numerous times. I'm a positive guy. My son is positive. We want to be. But at the same time, you know, you kind of have to address. So they're pushing guys that are 5'4 and 5'5. And let me quantify that. Jonathan Gresham is really who I'm talking about. And Jonathan Gresham is a very, very talented wrestler. But he's 5'4. And they're putting him in this angle with Bully Ray. And Bully Ray, obviously, I think he's 6'2 or 6'3, something like that. And they're putting him in this angle. And the angle actually played off well. It's David versus Goliath. But a couple of things were said by Ian Riccoboni, who is the television commentator and actually lives, Jeff. I don't think I even mentioned this to you, but Ian Riccoboni lives 10 minutes from where I live and actually goes to the same high school He goes to the same high school as both of my kids, but he went to the same high school as both of my kids. But he tagged Jonathan Gresham as the best pure technical wrestler in the world today. And, you know, look, I've been a wrestling fan for 47 fucking years at this point. I've heard every sort of hyperbole and bullshit known to man, but are you really going to say the best pure technical wrestler on the planet today? You know, really? Okay. That's not, you know. So I think what they're trying to do, and this is where I don't hold them at fault, is that they have a really depleted base of wrestlers right now. You know, they lost Kyle O'Reilly, and they lost Roderick Strong and Bobby Fish and Adam Cole, and ACH went to Evolve, and, you know, just a bunch of guys in the last year or 2 or 3 years have gone. You know, Ciampa was there. I remember seeing Ciampa at a show a few years back. So they're really trying to do the best with what they have. At the same time, when you sit in the audience for 5 hours and then you start getting, you know, cheeseburger versus Will Ferrara matches, and it was real funny because Eric said, watch, 4 hours in, they're going to tote out Will Ferrara, and we're going to get a Will Ferrara match. And Will Ferrara is actually a good worker, but he's also about 5'4 and 5'5. It's a little painful to take. So, you know, if you're going to put on 5 hours of a product, it's really got to be completely stellar from start to finish, in my opinion, to keep the interest. And, you know, again, there were some real high moments here. The main event was very good. Again, I think the Young Bucks could work with anybody at any time, and they could have a good match because they had a match. It was the Beer City Bruiser, Silas Young, and I think the other guy's name was Kingpin. And I'm not really familiar with Kingpin, but, you know, he's definitely limited. He's a really, really big guy. But the Bucks did a great job of working this match. So, you know, all in all, still a lot of fun. But, you know, I this is not the ROH that it was 2 years ago, 4 years, and 6 years ago.
So, a couple things. I really enjoyed myself. I got a chance to sit with Eric and spend the night talking wrestling and sharing courthouse stories because we both work at different courthouses around the country. A couple things that notes that I made on the show. They had a match with Sumi Sakai and Tasha Steele. And when they came out, they introduced Tasha Steele as being from Puerto Rico. And a guy in the crowd says, she's really Dominican, which I thought was really kind of funny. And then afterwards, when Sumi went to speak, she began to speak and somebody in the crowd yelled out, speak English. And she says, I can speak English, broken English, which is really funny. And when Gresham, they did an angle with Gresham and Bully Ray, as Barry was pointing out. And he said, you know, 20 years ago, I watched Devon carry your ass in this building. And that got quite the pop from the crowd. Other matches we had Scorpio Sky, Christopher Daniels, and Frankie Kazarian. I can't remember what the name of that group is. I got to be honest with you, Barry, just for the folks' edification, I really don't watch a lot of ROH. So some of the names of these groups, I know the wrestlers, but I don't know what like their group name is or anything like that. But they faced the Briscoes and Punishment Martinez, had an incredible go-home spot on that. Let's see what else. A funny moment during the card, I turned to Eric. And this is something because Eric's such a big fan of Japanese wrestling. And I said, you know, nobody in wrestling wins with a roll up anymore. Everybody has to, you know, it's the end of the match when they hit their big, you know, with Omega, the one wing angel or, you know, different guys with their big go home finisher. That's what they've got to end the match with. Nobody ever wins with a roll up. And then, of course, the next three matches on the taping all ended with a roll up. So, you know, just because I'm such an idiot. But, let's see what else. The stuff, you know, one of the things I wanted to point out with the stuff with Bully Ray and what was the name of the guy? Gresham, the guy that he was working with. I told Eric the night of the match, and then they did another thing with Punishment Martinez.
Martinez
versus a guy named Aaron Solo, who's another small guy. And I said, you know, one thing that I don't understand why promoters don't use today, because it's been, let's say, and it's an angle that's been used over and over and again. And if you use it right, it's really effective. It's basically the angle that the WWE used in the, I don't know, like the early to mid 90s with Razor Ramon and the 1-2-3 Kid, where you have, you know, what you do is you have a guy face off with a guy bigger than him. And the first match, the big guy gets disqualified for some reason. It throws him over the top rope or won't let up. but he loses the match. So they come back the next week. Now the big guy is going to get his, he wants to get the win, by God, because he got the loser's share of the paycheck last week. And you do some kind of schmoz where it's like a double count out. He still doesn't get the win over the kid, though. And then the third match, you come back and you have him go to a 10-minute TV time limit draw. And by God, now the fans are really getting behind his young kid because the big star, the bigger guy, hasn't been able to beat him yet. Then you run a fourth week. You've got an entire month's worth of a program on television at this point, and you have the guy, the younger guy, pull some kind of crazy upset, like, you know, 9 minutes and 56 seconds into the match, he manages to sneak a 1-2-3 on the guy. And, you know, I just think this is an opportunity that they could have used with Gresham and Bully. They could have used with Aaron Solo and Punishment Martinez. Do something like that. So it's not just the big guy squashing the little guy. You know, it just seems such a, like, such a waste. The other thing, you know, you talked about the pros and cons of the taping. You know, one of the things, you were right, absolutely right. Bully Ray, he comes in. The guy's, what, 47 years old? We checked. Yeah. And he comes in there, and he completely dominated the taping because he was so much better, like I'm talking about on the stick, at least until the end of the show, than anybody else. He just completely dominated things. And his presence, his portrayal of the bully and the villain, you know, he really was quite effective. But, you know, by the same token, I'm sitting there thinking, but on the other hand, you're going back to somebody that's like a known variable. You're not building a new star. So if you're going to use this guy who's obviously got the name recognition, who's obviously means something to the people that come to this arena, why don't you use this guy to put somebody over and make somebody a star? And the reason I question this is because they ended up having Bully in a match with where he teamed with Silas Young versus Jay Lethal, who is their champion. And Gresham, and let's just say Jay Lethal didn't go over on the big lead heel, because that would have been an example of using Bully to put over a guy and say, well, oh, of course he'd be Bully Ray. He's our world champion, even if it's a tag match. Well, you know, Bully Ray can't beat our world champion. And I just think it's a ridiculous use of a very effective heel who at this point, he's 47. This guy's not going to have some kind of last run. He's in stinking ROH. Use the name recognition that he has and use it, you know, to put over your younger guys. I just don't understand that. Let's see what else. We had a four-way match with Chris Sabin, Flip Wilson, Shane Taylor, and Eli Mitchell.
Just said, was Geraldine there?
Flip Wilson, exactly. He did not come out and drag.
Flip Gordon.
I actually typed it into my phone as Flip Wilson. That's what kind of
awesome.
Idiot I am. So let's see. We had the reason I came for the show. I came because I wanted to see the villain, Marty Scurll. And so I go up there. And then, of course, not to spoil anything, he has a match with Shane Helms. OK, and it was a good match for about 11 minutes. But what kills me is after the match is over, he's going back. I don't know if it was. No, it wasn't after the match. It was at the end of the show. He walks past, you know, off the stage. And who gets a photo with him, Barry? Because this was the guy I came from Fort Lauderdale to go see. But who gets the fucking photo of Marty Scurll, Barry? Why don't you tell the good folks?
I did. I got the photo
you
with
son
Marty.
Of
a freebie, too. It was a freebie.
So that was good. Then the match you had discussed earlier was the Bucks and Cody versus Silas Young, Beer City Bruiser. And I believe the guy you referred to earlier was a guy named Brian. Is it Milonis? Is that his name?
I thought he was Kingpin. I have no idea.
Okay. His name's Brian Milonis, and his nickname is a Kingpin or something like that.
Okay, but gotcha.
Here's something that I also noticed in this match, in that the guys that were teaming with Silas Young, Beer City Bruiser and Brian Milonis, you don't see a lot of really good fat guys in pro wrestling anymore. Yeah, Kevin Owens is like, he's chubby. You know, I know Vince has some kind of personal aversion to using fat guys, but, you know, because you never see those guys in wrestling anymore, I see these guys and I'm like, oh, wow, these guys are different. You know, and we pointed out at the NXT, the guy, what's his name? Is it Trevor or Trent or something like that? That was in the mustache team or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Trent Seven.
Thank you. That he like looks a little, he's got a little belly on him and stuff like that. And these two guys come out and they're fat guys, and they're fat guys that really aren't terrible workers. They're actually pretty good. They take some good bumps. Beer City Bruiser does a dive from the top rope onto the floor. Yeah. And a guy his size, I actually sent him a note on Twitter and I said, dude, it was an incredible spot, but please don't worry about your career. Don't do that spot in every town you run, because you're going to end up shortening your career by 10 years. So, and then of course, as you said, we had Cody and all the guys from the Bullet Club come out. It was really good. Cody cut a hell of a promo. And I said, wow, he's definitely got his dad's promo ability. That's for damn sure. And then they had Marty Scurll saying the theme to, what's the Will Smith show? The
Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Well, of course, he references coming from West Philly. He got a huge pop from the crowd for that. It was actually very funny to watch Marty Scurll sing a theme song. That was really funny. But here's the thing is, Cody, during the promo, says, you know, we're getting ready to go to All In Chicago, and we sold 10,000-something tickets. And, you know, Dave Meltzer said that we couldn't do that. And immediately – just the cacophony of boos, and some guy in the audience goes, fuck Dave Meltzer. And I'm like, where did Dave Meltzer become this, you know, this heel in the city of Philadelphia or with this ROH crowd? Barry, can you even explain that to me?
Well, I mean, so Will, you know, the city of Philadelphia is infamous because we've thrown snowballs at Santa Claus previously. So is Meltzer a heel here? Sure, Meltzer is a heel because Cody said so. So we'll immediately jump on that. But yeah, they really did. They jumped all over Meltzer, man.
And the last thing I want to say, it was, you know, like I said, it was great seeing a bunch of old friends. One of the things I noted here, I got to tell a quick story about our old friend Ron Lemieux. So Ron Lemieux tells me he's staying in the Red Roof Inn. He just spent the night, came in for the show, and I just thought this was such a funny story. So we're sitting there at John's eating the Philly cheesesteak, and Ron goes, you know, I'm in the Red Roof Inn, and you know, there's this girl in the Red Roof Inn, and she's kind of thin. And, you know, she's come up to me in the lobby three times and said, hey, how you doing? How's it going? And he goes, this isn't looking good. I go, what the fuck are you doing staying at a Red Roof Inn, you cheap bastard? Why don't you go stay at a better place than that? So Ron getting approached apparently by the hookers in the Red Roof Inn. I'm happy to report to Mrs. Lemieux that Ron did not, in fact, take them up on the offer. Apparently they wouldn't accept credit cards, which is why he wouldn't be able to do that. So now, Barry, good Lord, yeah. We're probably an hour into the show, and it's time to talk about the wrestling match we want to talk about.
Well, one thing I want to bring up before we move on, too, and I think this is really
Is it about
important.
Ron Lemieux and the hooker?
No, and I like that, actually. I definitely think we should probably talk about that. But is there's a huge rumor going out there that Cody Rhodes, the Young Bucks, Marty Scurll, and Hangman Adam Page are going to stay together. They've made this pact that if one goes, they're all going to go. So there's this big rumor that the WWE wants to bring in the Young Bucks, but if they want to take the Young Bucks, you got to take Cody, Marty Scurll, and Hangman Adam Page. So there is a big rumor that they're all going to go to the WWE. What happens to ROH if those five guys leave?
What happens to ROH? What happens to New Japan? I mean, that would have a real dent on the depth of a talent from this country that goes over to work the big New Japan shows. I mean, obviously, New Japan has the Japanese talent that will keep them, you know, going strong, but it will really affect the ability for them to have, you know, foreigners that are super over come over there. But I mean, besides Omega. But, yeah, I think that would put them in a position where they would have to, you know, Michael Elgin and guys like that would have to become a much bigger face within the promotion, Juice Robinson, those kind of guys. So, I really hope it doesn't happen because, you know, this whole thing that has just started up where they've created this whole all-in thing where, you know, they have people talking about independent wrestling. They have people talking about products other than the WWE, and that's always a positive because, you know, just one group and one company, you know, you don't have places. And if people see the WWE as sort of the end zone on the football field that is wrestling, you know, that you finally get there because, you know, if those guys go there, Cody's already been there. If Cody goes there, if Marty Scurll goes there, Hangman Page and the Young Bucks, you know they're going to screw those guys, and they're going to do something, and they're going to be working, thinking middle of the card maybe. The Young Bucks are never going to get pushed to the top of the card, no matter how good they are. They're never going to get pushed to the top of the card of a WWE. Can you see the Young Bucks main eventing a WrestleMania, for God's sake? Of course not. And yeah, so, you know, but it will definitely be a case of, you know, I'm sure if they did bring him in, they're going to get a money offer that they couldn't get anywhere else. And it will be more than they make at New Japan. I mean, you've got to factor in the, you know, the whole travel, you know, like traveling over to Japan, staying over there for a, like, you know, 3 weeks, a month at a time. You know, there's certainly that factor. You know, they're their own boss. Is that something that gets tiring after a while? And you know, you prefer the whole, facilitation that the WWE does, where they're scheduling where you're going to be. And, you know, there's a certain comfort in knowing where you're going to be for X amount of years. But I really hope it doesn't happen, because if it does, it'll really put a crimp in a lot of different products. So
yeah, and that's something too. So something else I also read was that there's a rumor, and with wrestling, there just seems to be all these rumors. It's, you know, the journalism factor in wrestling on the internet, especially on Facebook, it doesn't exist. It's absolutely horrific. But from somebody that I trust, a source that I trust, was that Cody, Page, the Bucks, and Skrull would actually start their own promotion. And they would actually start it, own it, and run it. And that's kind of interesting, because again, my guess is they would probably work hand in hand with ROH, New Japan, but it would be kind of a promotion where they would get guys from all over. So I find that interesting. And before I forget, because I found this interesting, were you aware of the situation this past week with this 12-year-old female fan named Izzy? I don't know how I just segue from that to that, but were you aware of this whole thing? And do you even know who Izzy even is?
I happen to see the thing on, I don't know if it's Facebook or Twitter. Jim Cornette talked about it on his last episode with Brian. So I do know the situation you're talking about.
So what's your take on it? So just in case if people don't know, there's a super fan named Izzy. She kind of came to prominence because she was at every NXT taping, and she was considered Bayley, who is now on the main roster, her number one fan. Bayley would come out. She would always hug Izzy. They would always show Izzy. And Izzy was literally a celebrity in the crowd. And Izzy this past week took a choke slam from a male wrestler, and then I believe defeated him and won a title, if I'm correct. And I had a chance to see it, and I had some thoughts on this whole thing. And there's been, I guess, the reason that I guess I'm interested in this story above everything else is the reactions from people. And it's really not the reactions from fans, because every fan is an expert. Not for gimmick infringement, but every fan is a booker. Everybody knows better than the people actually doing it. So, but when I see the reactions and some of the comments from people within the industry and the business, that's really what I thought was interesting. So what did you think about the whole thing?
I guess my first reaction was I thought about the famous Kenny Omega match with the young girl, where Jim Cornette about stroked out when he saw it, feeling that Kenny Omega was exposing the business. Obviously, the guy that had the match with Izzy, I don't even know what his name was, but he's obviously not a star. And, you know, to be honest with you, when Kenny Omega had the match with the girl, he was not a star anywhere near the level he is now. I think he was relatively new to Japan at the time of the match he had with the little girl. You know, I know Jim was saying, I have to say there's a certain validity to this point was, you know, geez, this young girl, 11 years old, she's still developing, and, you know, and you give her a power slam. What if she hit her head? What if she hit her head and 11 years old sustains a concussion? You know, and where were her parents? Were they right? You know, signing off on this? I have to assume the parents were okay with it, but, you know, is this something that, you know, is showing being a responsible parent, allowing your 11-year-old child to be in the ring and taking a bump? Maybe the parents didn't know their child was going to take a bump like that. I don't know.
Yeah, so I am going to interject, because as I read, and there's been so much misinformation. So her parents knew. This young female, Izzy, has been training to be a wrestler. She is currently in training to be a wrestler, and she had both of her parents' full support in doing this. So they had worked out the spot. But, you know, I listened to an interview from her dad, and her dad obviously has been getting destroyed over the internet. And her dad brings up some really, really good points, and he says, you know, on a daily basis, you can open up the newspaper and you can read about a child that's been injured either playing rugby, field hockey, football, or even karate. That every day at some junior high, high school, or somewhere, that there are kids that suffer injuries. This was a spot that was worked out ahead of time. If you notice, the wrestler, the male wrestler, I believe his name is Effie, which is really a horrific name for a male wrestler, by the way. But this guy, Effie, basically was gentle when he was bringing her down. She still wound up taking a choke slam. But the father's point was, you look at the amount of injuries in rugby, in football, et cetera, and they're almost astronomical. You know, with whether it's a concussion or whether it's a broken arm or a leg, in some cases paralyzation, in some cases even death, that's occurred over the last couple of years. So in my opinion, that was a really, really good argument. But in listening to some of the people in the business who find this offensive and who find this an embarrassment, and there's a wrestler named Lince Dorado, and I believe he's a Florida guy. And he's a fine worker. I believe he's on 205 Live, and he sent out a tweet, and it said, "I will not support this at all, and I will leave it at that. As a parent and professional wrestler, I feel utterly embarrassed due to my peers' actions. Not okay." And I just find that, I find it, and look, again, I don't know Lince Dorado from Doritos, so I don't have any idea. But at the same time, you know, to say that, when you work for a company where Mae Young gave birth to a hand, where Heidenreich did this rape angle with Michael Cole, where you've got the boogeyman with worms coming out of his mouth, when you consider all of the racist and misogynistic angles that the WWE has done over the last 30 years, and some of them have been absolutely beyond stupid. I mean, Joey Ryan in the dick spot, you know, and that's not WWE, but when you work for a company that has perpetuated the Kiss My Ass Club, and literally there's been a million angles, and yet you have a problem with a guy giving the 12-year-old a fucking chokeslam. A 9-year-old kid held the WWE tag team titles earlier this year. Now, granted, he didn't take a bump, but that was still the guy holding the titles. It's just amazing. And this was, you know, Kevin Orcutt, who is a member, and he, you know, when this whole thing was going down over Dave Meltzer's comment about one of the Iconics looking a little heavier, and I, you know, 3 weeks later, I totally forget what he even said, that she was lighter in NXT. You know, there was this moral outrage from people within the WWE coming to her defense. I didn't see one fucking superstar of the WWE talk about Randy Orton and the fact that he was sexually harassing and grabbing his dick and then going to touch people with it, and bullying, which is essentially bullying. These were writers. These aren't athletes. He was bullying the writers and just walking around with his dick out. But I didn't read anybody complain about that. You know, which is really amazing. So, you know, you've got these people that, you know, that work for this company that want to criticize everything that happens out of the company, but let alone when something terrible takes place in the company, they're all dead silent. You lose zero, you have zero credibility in that case. So, look, this whole thing to me about her taking the bump, it's much ado about nothing. Really, kind of like Meltzer's comment as well, it's really much ado about nothing. But this moral outrage from people that collect a paycheck from this machine that perpetuates Mae Young giving birth to a hand, the Katie Vick angle, I mean, you know, the stupidest, most offensive angles of all time, and you have an issue with this? Really? Please, give me a break.
Okay, I got one question for you, Barry. Just sure. taking the, I'm not even going to say the opposite approach, but let me ask you, you're a father of a young girl. Zoe is what, 13?
Zoe turned 14 on 14. July 19th.
Okay. So Zoe, a couple years ago, had really started getting into watching wrestling with her dad at age 12 or 13. Do you let Zoe take that bump?
This is the whole – do I let Zoe take that bump? I'm not going to say yes or no. My first incline is to say no. But here's the difference. This girl has been training. She isn't currently training to be a professional wrestler. So, again, this is not a girl that has just been a fan that walks into a ring and takes a bump. She is in training to be a professional wrestler. When I listen to her father is very supportive. He goes, if she wanted to be a ballerina, I would do everything within my power to make sure she receives the best training possible to become the best ballerina she can become. She wants to be a wrestler. She wakes up in the morning. It's all she talks about. She goes to bed at night. Her entire room is covered. She is in training several days a week now to be a pro wrestler. And he goes, I guarantee you my daughter's going to be a wrestler. Conversely, I get it. What if she takes a bump and what if she gets injured? You know what I mean? What if something happens? You know, I've got a kid that lives four houses over from me that does that parkour stuff with the flips on the concrete and all that. What if he takes one of these flips and I think he's 14 years old as well. What if he takes one of these flips and he lands on his head? And, you know, is his dad supposed to say, I never want to see you doing this again? You know, you can't. And for me, it's, you know, would I allow Zoe to do it? I can't say yes or no in that situation. With the right training, and I get it, 12 years old, you know, you're still developing, so I get all that. But to that end, I also heard X-Pac, Sean Waltman, and I forget exactly, but he said, this is not cool. And he said, where's the parenting in this WTF? How old was X-Pac when he started training? Because Pete, our friend Pete Lederberg has got photos of X-Pac training. He looks about 13 or 14 years old training with Professor Boris Malenko. So, you know, to me, pot kettle black on that one. So, would I let Zoe? I don't know. But to me, it's a completely different scenario. This girl is training. She's doing it. I support it. To me, I think it is safer than her doing rugby. I used to work with a kid that was one of the best employees I had. He was 17 years old. He was a busboy in a restaurant, and he suffered a traumatic brain injury playing rugby. And that was it. He didn't work anymore. And he got better, but he has serious issues going forward. So, you know, look, you want to take a bump that you've practiced, that you've trained for. I find that safer than rugby.
Yeah, no, valid point. I just I thought it was a question that just to show both sides of the equation, because I know that on his show, Cornette spoke about, yeah, it had more to do, you know, in the case of the Joey Ryan stuff, that's more, he feels like it's a guy that who actually is a wrestler, you know, doing stuff, you know, with the dick spot and all that kind of stuff, and that bothers him. This was more of a case of the safety of the young lady and you know, whether or not she's physically mature enough.
And I absolutely get that. And the dick spot, look, he's a grown man. But, you know, one of the things that I saw, and this was – so a lot of the independent wrestlers that are out there are an absolute up in arms over this. And one guy that I'm Facebook friends said – you are making a mockery of my profession. And again, I go back to, she's making a mockery? You got a guy fucking doing the dick spot. The mockery has been going on forever. For absolute ever. Don't fucking pick on a 12-year-old girl. This mockery. I mean, you know, you and I have seen, as many of our listeners, or most of them, we've seen some really stupid, bottom-feeding, stupid, offensive shit over the years. And if this is a mockery, please, you're barking up the wrong tree, because I can name 100 things that I think are worse than this, in my opinion. I get the safety aspect, but again, I'll always go back to where I truly believe, you know, football, rugby, field hockey, whatever it is, there's serious injuries that occur in this. And again, I feel that she was protected and she's been training for this. So, and I may even catch some heat for these comments. Who knows? But I believe in that. So.
All righty. Well, now here we are going to call an audible on this fine program, folks, because Barry and I have spent so much time talking about ROH, talking about this young lady that is training to be a wrestler, that unfortunately, what we're going to do is we are going to put off the Terry Funk Harley race match until next week's show, because we want to give it some time. Barry, I think maybe it's time for us to do a podcast, an episode where we talk maybe about three or four matches, because we got to catch up on some of this stuff we've been watching, Barry. And let me just give a little shout out to some of you fine listeners who inbox me or contact me through Facebook Messenger, and you suggest different matches. I have more than one person doing that, and they'll say, did you watch this match? This is a great match. And, you know, our friend, you mentioned Kevin Orcutt. Have you watched this Nick Bockwinkel versus Tito Santana match? And I had a guy – Sean from England asked me if I'd seen the Bryan Danielson versus Nigel McGuinness match. And, I absolutely encourage everyone, if you have a suggestion for us, I encourage you, hey, check this match out. We never have a problem with that. But please understand, I have a job. I try to squeeze in as many matches, especially, good Lord, with college football season starting. It's going to be even harder, Barry. But we do appreciate all of the suggestions. When we get a chance, we are going to get to them, and we'll talk about them in the future. If you think this is a great match, quite honestly, if we watch the match and we think it's a crappy match, we're going to tell you, what the hell did you suggest this match for? It was a crappy match. So we are going to get to the Terry Funk Harley Race match next week. Calling an audible, me and Mr. Rose here. And now, Barry, are we ready for that top five? You got anything else you want to ask?
No, we got to say, too, it's a great match between, I mean, it really, has Terry Funk ever been in a bad match? But it's Terry Funk versus Harley Race, 2 out of 3 falls, NWA title from 1977. The quality of the film footage is crystal, like it was shot yesterday. This is something that I think, and it literally, I joke about it, but there's a hint of truth in that, and that sometimes with these matches that go 46 and 47 or an hour long, I don't know if it's my ADD or the fact that I just don't even have the time, but this was an easy 46 minutes because I felt like I was watching two old friends wrestle. So it really is tremendous, and you know, I look forward to discussing it next week. Absolutely.
Okay, so now we are going to talk about our top five one-hit wonders of the 80s. Now, before we start delving into this list, let me just quantify a couple things here. Because, you know, Barry, when I started looking at some of these songs, and I'd say, oh, what about this one? And I look on their Wikipedia page, or I Google them, and come to find out they've had, you know, a couple other hits, or maybe like in your number 38, 39. They made the top 40, but they just barely skirted it before they went back out again. Or you got some guys that maybe were over in England, had a number of hits, but had one hit in the United States. So for the purpose of this, we're looking for a group or a person that had one hit, a significant hit in this country. We're not going to count those, you know, ones that got to number 63, but never went anywhere else. And that was the only album they had that meant anything. So, you know, bear with us if you listen to this and you say, oh, shit, what are they talking about? One hit wonder. That guy was huge in Bulgaria. You know, just
yeah, exactly.
Relax. And so this is our opinions. So we're going to give our top five one hit wonders from the 80s. Barry, start us off.
Yes, sir. And so I think I told you I had a list of like 20. It was probably a list of 40, and I completely have narrowed it down. And even right now, I've got 15 in front of me, and I'm just going to kind of blindly pick them out. But I am going to go number five is The Genius of Love by the Tom Tom Club. So I know you know this song. It was these guys were an offshoot of the Talking Heads, and I obviously love the Talking Heads tremendously, but this was the married couple, Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth, and they did this song called The Genius of Love. If you went to a nightclub or a disco in the 1980s, especially the first half of the 80s, you heard this song. And this song still plays to this day. I can turn on my Sirius XM. It's so catchy. It's so fun. It's light. There's not, you know, this isn't one of these deeply political U2 Bloody Sunday songs in any form. This is just goofball fun, but it's really catchy. And this song peaked actually at number 31 on the Billboard Hot 100 in April of 1982. And here it is some 36 years later. And I think I heard it on the radio yesterday. So great song. Talking Heads, just tremendous. You know, David Byrne, who is the founder of the Talking Heads, is on tour now. He's doing a solo tour, and he's actually coming to Philly, and I'm going to go see him. And there was another guy named Jerry Harrison that was in the band, and Jerry Harrison had this amazing song. If we ever do, and maybe I should save it, because if we ever do an episode where it's the five songs you've never heard that would blow you away, Jerry Harrison is on that list. He had a song in 1988 called Man with a Gun, and it is an eerie kind of creepy song, but it's just amazing. And Jerry Harrison now, I believe, is he's a teacher at NYU, which I think is cool. So for me, yeah, Genius of Love, Tom Tom Club, number 5 this week on the Billboard Hot 100.
All righty. My number 5, I am going to 1987, the Australian group Midnight Oil. Did a song called Beds Are Burning, got to number 17 in the United States, and was listed as one of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's 500 songs that shaped rock and roll. This is a song, this group is, I guess, really into the whole ecology and taking care of Mother Earth and all that kind of stuff. And
you know what the Beds Are Burning is about, right?
Oh, go ahead and tell us.
Oh, absolutely, too. And I got to say, so this really falls into what you were saying. They had some minor hits in the U.S. In Australia, these guys are still like the biggest thing going. I mean, and the lead singer, I totally forget what his name is. I believe he is part of the parliament in Australia. But the Beds Are Burning essentially had to do with the murder of the Aboriginal natives,
yes,
of Australia.
I did read that. You're correct.
Yeah. So it's a really, you're right when they talk about Mother Earth. They're extremely political and very, very conscious of that. And it's just a tremendous song, a tremendous, remember the video? Tremendous video. And he's very striking, the guy. He's like 6'6", 6'7", bald. Looks like he could just break you in half. But great song. A great song.
And they actually performed it at the closing ceremonies of the 2000 Olympics in Sydney, I believe.
Oh, wow. There you go.
Yeah. So good times. All right. Number 4, Barry.
So number 4 for me is a song by the classic band Kajagoogoo. And it's Too Shy, which everybody knows. You're Too Shy, Shy, Hush, Hush, Eye to Eye. And what a great song. This had a great vibe. I remember the cool thing, you know, so being old, like you and I are old, Jeff, and luckily you're older than I am, so I can take some solace with that. But we were part of the early days of MTV, and my God, you know, we talk about being fortunate with seeing wrestling. Let's be honest, those early days of MTV were the greatest fucking things ever. And we, you know, I don't know if you were like me, but I think most of America really was. We watched every video. We saw all this shit happening. So to me, you know, Kajagoogoo and Too Shy Shy, what a great video. Lead singer was Lamal. And Lamal was apparently such a douchebag that they fired him as this song was breaking. Apparently, he had a different vision. He wanted to be a big star. The band was more concerned with music, and they fired him, and they got a new lead singer, and Kajagoogoo never had any success. Lamal actually had a little bit of success as a solo artist. If you remember, he sang the theme song to Never Ending Story, which I think is a great song, and he was on a British TV show 5 years ago, give or take, and apparently was still a douche. That, you know, I guess they got him right off this TV show. It might have been the Big Brother version in England, the English version of Big Brother. So apparently was a douche, and they voted him right off. Still is the pain in the ass, but Too Shy, Hush, Hush, Eye to Eye.
So what we could say, and this is for our friend Greenbaum, if we're looking for a shirt, Shawn Michaels, huge asshole, Lamal, big douchebag. Does that work
yes.
for you?
Absolutely. No royalties required either.
Yes. I'll get that to the printers this weekend, Barry. So my number four song is by the group After the Fire. Came out in 1983. Oh. It was a song that was actually written by Falco.
Yes.
Who, of course, was a big. He was big news in Austria, Barry, but and also had his own one-hit wonder with "Rock Me Amadeus." But the song I'm talking about is, of course, "Der Kommissar." Der Kommissar is back in town. The song got to number 5 on the Billboard Hot 100. I believe the song was recorded by After the Fire after Falco had done the song a couple years before. So he had actually was a year. Let me see when Falco's came out. It came out in 1981, and the After the Fire, I'm sorry, it wasn't 82, came out in 19, it wasn't, let me try that again, folks. Falco's song came out in 81, the After the Fire version came out in 82. Tell me what you remember about Der Kommissar, Barry.
Yeah, so Falco, I think you're right, too. So Falco had Der Kommissar, and what was the other song?
Rock Me Amadeus.
Rock Me Amadeus, and then I think after the fire did the American version. Is that correct?
That's pretty much about what it was. Yeah.
I think it was the American version in English where Falco had done it in German because they were, I believe he's dead as well, but he was German. So it was, I mean, look, again, if you were from that generation, you knew these songs, and MTV was the huge piece in getting this all across. But these were songs that were catchy. These were songs that when they come on, I start tapping the steering wheel. I will tell you, I was driving 2 or 3 years ago, and I was in an area called Bordentown, New Jersey, and they were listing bands that were playing at this local record shop. And this local record shop is kind of cool because it only seats maybe 50 people. And they had 5 or 6 artists listed, and I didn't know who any of these people were. And there it said, After the Fire. And I knew right away, I'm like, holy shit, there it is, Der Kommissar. So I didn't go see them, but yeah, that's a fun song.
Yeah. So, okay, Barry, your number three choice.
So my number three choice, Jeff, somebody that you and I were discussing at great length over this past weekend as you made your trip to Philly, it is 1982, Someday, Someway by Marshall Crenshaw. And Marshall Crenshaw was one of those guys that had this song. This is one of the most catchy songs ever. This is a song that when I play it in my car and my daughter heard it, and I think the first time she heard it, she was probably 7 or 8, she started singing the song because it's so catchy. There's not a lot of lyrics here. You know, the chorus is repeated about 30 times. But Marshall Crenshaw kind of exploded with this song, and this was kind of that rockabilly segment of the new wave era. And there was a quote in Trouser Press, and it said, although Marshall Crenshaw was seen as a latter-day Buddy Holly at the outset, he soon proved too talented and original to be anyone but himself. And I agree with it, but unfortunately he's never had another hit since 1982. He does have an opportunity right now. New Jersey's own The Smithereens lost their lead singer last year, or actually earlier this year, which was Pat D'Anizio. And Marshall Crenshaw is actually stepping in and will be singing some of these songs with The Smithereens when they go on tour. So I'm a big fan of this guy. You know, I'd like to see him have some sort of career resurgence because I certainly think he's got the talent for it. And hopefully this will actually do it.
If I'm not mistaken, did he not play Buddy Holly in La Bamba?
He did play Buddy Holly in La Bamba, yeah. He did.
So, okay, it is time for my number three. Barry, I'm going to cheat a little bit here, and I hope you will allow me. As my number three, I'm going to come by. It's a tie. I am going, and they both appeared in the movie Valley Girl, which we have discussed with Nicolas Cage, Deborah Foreman. And the two songs, and to me, they're very similar songs. It's by Modern English, I Melt With You, and by the Plimsolls, a song called A Million Miles Away. They were both featured, and I'm not even sure the one by the Plimsolls charted. The one by Modern English got to number 76 on the old Hot 100, the Billboard charts. So, but these two songs just resonated. Matter of fact, Modern English, I told Barry earlier today, was part of the soundtrack of my wedding to Mrs. Bowdrin, currently number three Mrs. Bowdrin, Mr. Smartass. He asked me, which wife? And so it was wife number three, Mrs. Bowdrin, and because it's such a great romantic song that was such of its time. Because when that song, when the two songs come on during the soundtrack of Valley Girl, which is such a, to this day, you can watch it. It's such a great movie about just kids dealing with, you know, growing up and everything that happens with bullshit in high school and just trying to connect with someone on any kind of way. And both these songs really spoke to me. And I think they're both still to this day really good songs, Barry.
Well, I mean, everything you just said is 100% correct. And this is the right Mrs. Bowdrin as well.
Hey, now.
When we did our top movie soundtracks, Valley Girl, I believe was my number two. I'd have to go back, but I know it was right there. And a lot of it was the two songs that you mentioned. There was a third song also by Josie Cotton called Johnny, Are You Queer? And it's a great song. It certainly couldn't play in today's political climate because a lot of people would get very offended by it. So I'll Stop the World and Melt With You, Modern English. That's the definition of a one-hit wonder. These guys never did anything else. To their credit, everything that I've read about them is they've embraced that. They still are. I'm going to see them in concert next month. So to give you an idea. Yes, they're with Flock of Seagulls and Wang Chung. They're with really a whole bunch of one-hit wonder type bands, and they're going to be there. And they sold that the rights to that song to everybody and their mother. I know Burger King had it for a year, and they were doing something with melted cheese, and that's a melt with you. But they've sold the rights, they've milked that, and God bless them because they embrace it, which is great. There's no issue with that. Now, my personal connection with the second song, the Plimsolls, were absolutely – so, again, if we're talking about bands of the 80s that people outside of Los Angeles probably never heard other than this song, the Plimsolls are right there. And the lead singer – and this is going to slide into my number two song, Jeff, in a minute, and I'm going to tell you why. The lead singer's name is Peter Case. And Peter Case, the Plimsolls broke up years ago, but he still performs out in Los Angeles, and he still has a great following. And I actually had the chance to meet Peter Case about, it would have been 11 years ago. So I can't believe it's been that long. I was going to say, like 4 years ago. So in 2007, I met Peter Case, and he was performing with my number two artist. So I'm going to slide into it and then I'll tell that story. My number two song, Jeff, is Mexican Radio by Walla Voodoo. So the lead singer of Mexican Radio of Walla Voodoo is a guy named Stan Ridgway. And I have seen Stan Ridgway in concert, I'll say 8 or 9 times. My son has seen him 4 or 5 times. My wife has seen him. Even my daughter has seen him. And I've seen him at larger venues. And when I say larger, 800 people. And I've seen him in venues where, you know, there's been 75 people there. So it's small, but he's Mexican Radio. First Mexican Radio was just the most catchy, fun song. But this guy has had a great solo career, Stan Ridgway, and he's kind of been described as Tom Waits-like. He's an American storyteller. But one of his best friends is Peter Case, the lead singer of the Plimsolls. So I happened to see Stan Ridgway in concert at a place in Hoboken, New Jersey in 2007. And I made the drive from Philly to Hoboken to see him, and Peter Case was playing. When I walk into the venue, it's a bar on the first floor, and on the second floor, in the basement, is where they perform the concerts. And I showed up probably an hour and a half, 2 hours early. I was going to get something to eat. I was with a friend of mine. So we're sitting at a table. We're eating burgers or whatever. And I look around, and in comes Stan Ridgway with a guy. I don't know who this guy is. And they sit down at the at a table, and they start to get some beverages, adult beverages. So I was like, fuck, I got to do this. So I eat quickly, and my friend and I, who really had no idea who these guys were, we make our way over. And I was like, hey, Stan Ridgway, you know, I've seen you in concert 4 or 5 times. I love you. You're great. And I said, can I buy you a drink? He said, anybody that wants to buy me a drink can have a seat. That's all I needed to hear, Jeff. So my big ass sits down in a chair. My friend sits down and he goes, this is my friend Peter Case. I did not know who Peter Case was. And as we're talking, it comes up that this was the lead singer of the Plimsolls, Peter Case. Wow. So, yeah, exactly. So you talk about like this added bonus. So all of a sudden, I'm sitting with one of my favorites of all time, which is Stan Ridgway, with the lead singer of the Plimsolls. And I'm buying these guys drinks. And they're happily accepting these drinks that I'm buying. So that's my Peter Case story, Plimsolls story. Great band. Again, this band should have been big. Million Miles Away is a fantastic song, but in the movie they have another song that they play as well, because they're playing at the prom at the end, if you remember correctly. And they had a couple of great records. They should have been huge. I still play their music to this day. I love them.
I was just sitting here thinking while you were having an adult beverage with those two men, you were probably a million miles away, Barry.
I was in heaven, yes.
Yes, absolutely. My number two comes from 1987. A guy, Barry, you know, I'm going to take a shot here and guess this was somebody, even as a big music aficionado as you may have never heard of this guy. This is how obscure this guy is as a one-hit wonder, Barry. 1987, there was a movie called Dirty Dancing, and there was an actor in that film, a guy named Swayze. And he did this song called She's Like the Wind. It was his only hit. Patrick Swayze. Have you ever heard of him, Barry? Patrick Swayze?
I'm really more familiar with his brother, Don, who does television commercials, but yes.
All I know is I stole this song from you, you bastard. I was like, nope, you're not getting Swayze. I'm taking Swayze. And we haven't mentioned him in at least two or three episodes, and I know how much you have talked about your man crush. It's a good pop song. You know, Swayze doesn't have, you know, he's not exactly one of the thundering voices of a generation, but it was what it was. It was a one-hit wonder for Patrick. God bless him. And we haven't mentioned him in a few weeks, so I thought I'd throw the Swayze fans out there the proverbial bone with She's Like the Wind.
Yeah, and it's, you know, so somebody posted this in our group a couple of months ago, and I got to be honest, it's kind of a brutal song. And I love all things Patrick Swayze, but, you know, it's kind of, but how many of these actors, if you look in the 80s, especially in the 80s for whatever reason, actors were releasing songs. Bruce Willis had a song. Eddie Murphy. Oh, my
God. Don Johnson.
Don Johnson, this guy Michael Damian, who was a one-hit wonder, but he was a soap opera actor.
Yeah.
Jack Wagner from General Hospital also had a one-hit wonder, but this was – and Don Johnson, you're right. That song was terrible. Remember that song?
Yes, in the video. Oh, my God. Where he's the cameraman in a war situation or something like that.
Yeah, in the war situation. Oh, these were terrible. But Swayze, you know, again, I guess of all the songs, maybe Swayze's was the best. It's definitely not my style of music.
Actually got to number 3 on the Billboard charts, Barry.
That's big. Absolutely big. And that's I would say that's based off of the movie and who was singing the song and not the song itself.
Yeah, sure. So, okay, Barry, it is time for your number one choice, my friend.
Absolutely. And this is one of the hardest decisions I'll make. So I am going to give you my dirty dozen of, I don't know if it's a dozen, but I'm going to give you some runner-ups just because for the sake of time, we'll move quickly. Jeff, a song that you and I were almost arm wrestling over and neither of us are going with it. Lunatic Fringe by Red Rider. Yes. Also from the movie Vision Quest, played about 4,000 times. And Miami Vice, and even Kurt Angle was coming out to this song while he was in TNA Impact. What's on Your Mind by Information Society, known for having Leonard Nimoy going pure energy. Love this song. Seeing those guys in concert, too. The Safety Dance, Men Without Hats. Voices Carry by Till Tuesday. Why Amy Mann is not a bigger star. I know why, but she's fantastic. In a Big Country by Big Country, one of my favorite songs of all time. A Twinge of Sadness, knowing what happened to the lead singer, but I still love the song. Take on Me by A-ha. Yes, they did have another song that was a hit called The Sun Always Shines on TV, but nobody knows that song. Everybody knows Take on Me. Somebody's Watching Me by Rockwell. If you remember that one, really famous because the guy couldn't sing and Michael Jackson just keeps coming. I always feel like, so everybody knows that song.
And that is our first time in the history of this show that Barry has sung.
Yeah. And hopefully will be the last time if everybody,
and it was a Rockwell song. I mean, come on.
And it was Rockwell who is Barry Gordy's
son. Yes, of course.
So of course he's going to have a big hit, but it was a catchy 99 Luftballons by the lovely Nana, which is an anti-war protest song. But my God, she was gorgeous then. And recent photos say she's still very attractive. She Blinded Me with Science.
I actually was thinking about that song. That was a great song.
Yeah, it's a great Thomas song. Thomas Dolby. Yep. And my last one before I get to my choice, We Don't Have to Take Our Clothes Off by Jermaine Stewart. This was a top 10 hit. This was remade in the last year by one of the current boy bands. But I don't know. This song, We Don't Have to Take Our Clothes Off to Have a Good Time, this comes on the radio, and for some reason I start smiling. But I do have a question. What the fuck is cherry wine? I need to know what the fuck cherry wine is, because he says we can drink some cherry wine, and I got to be honest, I don't know what cherry wine is. I've never seen cherry wine.
I think Boone's Farm had cherry wine, didn't they?
Along Farm. Big shout out again to my friend Peter Letterberg, who sent me a Boone's Farm meme yesterday. I will reveal this now. The first time I ever got drunk, I believe I was 14 years old. I was in the back of a car driven by Brian Berkowitz, Pete Lederberg in the passenger seat, and these two guys are feeding me bottles of Boone's Farm strawberry. So he sends me a photo of Boone's Farm yesterday as a reminder, and this was some 40 years ago. So yes, but my number one song is from 1983, Dexy's Midnight Runners, Come On Eileen. Now let's be honest, this is a true one-hit wonder. These guys, this was, I believe, if not the biggest song of 1983, it's certainly right up there. And this is the definition, because after this song, these guys fell off the radar. Kevin Rowland, who's the lead singer, developed this massive chip on his shoulder about this song, and these guys just faded into obscurity. But everybody, even if you're young, you've seen this video of these guys dressed up in overalls and kerchiefs, and they're doing this kind of Irish jig dance. But the cool thing is, in later years, this song has taken on a life of itself, where essentially it's become a porn title. And Come On Eileen has a completely different meaning than it did have 35 years ago.
Do you remember the joke that was out at the time?
What was the joke?
What is worse than Olivia Newton-John in Grease? Come On Eileen. Bada boom! Yes, that was an oldie but a goodie. Okay, Barry, it is time for my number one. I will also offer up a couple that didn't quite make my top five. I'm going to go 1982, Matthew Wilder, Break My Stride. Oh. Do you remember that song?
Oh, and never going to break my stride.
Oh, the reason that I remember that song, it is one of the few fond memories I have of my first wife. She loved that stinking song, and we used to always play it in the car. Let's see. The other one was 1981, Aldo Nova, Fantasy.
That's a great song.
Yeah, great intro to that song. My number
one. Why didn't he have a career?
Who knows? My number one, kind of a little backstory on that. You know, we recently had a chance. We were talking about God, Barry, I can't remember. It was like our favorite classic song, classic rock songs, or something like that. And I mentioned how much I love the David Bowie song, Space Odyssey. Space Oddity. I think I said Space Odyssey the first time we recorded the episode, too. But Space Oddity came out in 1969. So in 1983, a German artist named Peter Schilling did a song called Major Tom, which basically took that song and it created like a end story to it as to what happened to the character from the song that David Bowie wrote about. The song got to number 14 in the U.S. And one of the other reasons why I like this song, and it's almost like electronica, but it's one of those songs that I remember because I used to play classic rock in the car when my kids were growing up. And, you know, because I feel like the young people, they need direction, Barry. And so I would play Major Tom, and it got to the point where my daughter, who I've spoken about how my daughter has a real ear for music, even when she was a kid. And she would say, you know, is this a story song? And I would tell her the backstory. This is about an astronaut up in space. Da, da. And when this song would come on, she'd go, oh, it's the astronaut song. And it was like kind of a cute memory for me of my kids as they grew older. And this was a song that my kids really, as they were starting to learn about music and get into classic rock and stuff from the 80s. This was a song that every time this song came on the radio, my kids would pop. So I have a really nice memory of that song. So, Barry, that's our top five. I'm sure that once this show comes out, we'll be told what complete idiots we are because we forgot this song or that song.
I can't believe you forgot this song.
Yeah,
that's what we're going to get. Exactly. Five songs out of like 5,000, Jeff.
Exactly.
So, yes.
Exactly. How big an idiots are we? The answer is we're pretty big idiots, actually. So, yes, so Barry, you about ready to call it a day here, my friend?
Yeah, this is one of our longer shows, but I'm absolutely ready, and I can't wait till next week. This has been a lot of fun. I'll tell you, talking 80s music, and I'll give a shout out to my boy Gabe Daigle, who's actually your boy too.
Yes.
Out in Los Angeles.
Friend of the show.
Loves to talk about 1980s music, especially Los Angeles based. So you, Jeff, should have a conversation about the Plimsolls with him as well, because I'm sure he knows those guys well.
All right. And Barry, do you realize this is episode 48 that we're doing tonight? You know, Barry, we're getting close to that big, big episode 52. 1 year of Breaking Kayfabe on Life. Barry, can you believe it?
I can't believe it. So we're 4 weeks away. I know we've got some huge things planned. So I'm real excited about this as well. But, you know, I think the thing that astounds me, A, when you show me the numbers on a weekly basis, I'm humbled, and not humbled in the Iron Sheik way, but I'm always humbled by the numbers that are coming in, that that people are supporting us and people are there. So here we are almost a year later. I mean, it's insane. We're 11 months into doing this, and it's not tired. You know, I'm getting ready to leave my palatial recording studios right now, which you know is my basement, and I'm super jazzed up about this episode that we just recorded. So that excitement 11 months later is still there, and I'm loving it.
Well, two things. Obviously, it's time to walk Ozzy. Number two, as you talk about our growing numbers, the only thing I can think is that we're easily a lot more talented than we thought we are, or we have an audience that's easily entertained, which is probably the answer to that question. So, folks, I will encourage you to follow me at Bowdren Jeff on Twitter. Breaking Kayfabe, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. The great Brian Last. Did he give himself the name Great? That's my question. But anyway, until next week's show, for the great Brian Last and the Arcadian Vanguard Network, this is Barry Rose, Jeff Bowdren. Next week, folks.